And with that, Malcolm, I have to say, we also have now finally on the space, and I know that he was still racing about the house, Thomas Theiner, our next guest, having joined. Thomas.
Sorry, I had to unmute my microphone. Can you hear me?
Nope, we can hear you loud and clear. Welcome back.
Yeah, has been a long time. Hello, Malcolm. Hello, everybody. I am a bit busy
Welcome.
with work, so that's why I am not so much active currently on Twitter, which also annoys me very much with its racist owner. But since Alex actually asked me to be here today, I said I couldn't say no because it's important, no matter what happens, to support Ukraine because they are fighting for every one of us.
100% couldn't agree more, as our Ukrainian friends would say, "Duzhe dyakuyu." Thomas, Malcolm and I had been discussing this, and actually the day since we started at midnight Kiev time with Volodymyr Omelian, the former Minister of Infrastructure and our major of the ZSU and doing logistics close to the front line. We started with him and went through it with General McRyan. We've been talking in various forms and meandering through the topic of artillery ammunition again and again. One question which came up twice today, and this boils down to what we can actually do. There is still a lot of artillery ammunition in Western European stocks. And there's a
Yes.
number of nations, and you and I know them, who haven't yet passed that on. Is that not a little bit amoral, given the fact what kind of shortage we now see in Ukraine and what this is driving the Ukrainians to do whilst they're waiting for a grander solution?
The problem is that the generals, as Malcolm knows, officers get tasked by politicians to have forces ready for certain contingencies. And if you're a general, you will sit on your shells to be ready for those contingencies. As you see, in Israel, you never know when you need the ammunition yourself. And there's generals out there who are like, well, you're a politician. You tasked us to be ready for three contingencies at the same time, which requires X amount of artillery shells, X amounts of tanks and ammunition of this and that. And until politicians overrule that and take the responsibility for whatever might happen, if these stocks are not there, generals will sit on their ammunition and not approve a transfer to Ukraine right now. Like in Denmark, the military was like, we should give Ukraine all our artillery. And the politicians were like, yes, hand it over. But then we do not have artillery for like 2 years. And the politicians were like, well, fine. We take the responsibility. And the generals were then like, okay, you're the choice. You can do it. Take it. In Europe, the politicians are too scared and too ignorant to make this decision. And the generals are obviously not going out there and telling the politicians, take the ammunition, because, I mean, I can just speak for Italy. Italy promised NATO, no matter what kind of contingency, NATO can count on two heavy brigades, two medium brigades, and two light brigades from Italy in a war scenario. And sure, right now the Italian military sits on artillery howitzers and shells and infantry fighting vehicles that are not needed right now, but the generals are saying correctly. When I took the job as commander of the army, one of my duties is to have these six brigades combat ready for the moment NATO calls. If you take this or that away from me, one or two or three brigades are not combat ready any longer. Will you, politician, take the responsibility? And politicians here are like, we have all a bunch of cowed, fearful politicians in Europe. That's the problem. And in Denmark, they were like, yes, we take the responsibility, now start shipping. Or, for example, just when the war began 2 years ago, shortly before that, the British Defense Minister, Malcolm Wallace, said, we are going to ship Ukraine thousands of our Enlow anti-tank weapons. And the British military was like, no, because that cuts in our readiness. And Wallace and Boris Johnson were like, fine. Nobody's going to attack the UK with an invasion fleet, especially not the Russians, because they don't have the fleet to attack the UK. And until the Russians are ready to, let's say, attack a British ally, it will take quite some time when they are busy in Ukraine. And so the Ukrainians got like 8,000, 9,000 and loss, which the British military didn't want to part, because the job of the British military was to have those ready in case the British military needs it. And so we need more politicians like Ben Wallace, Boris Johnson, or Frederiksen in Denmark, who are like, I take the responsibility. In my view, we could give Ukraine everything they want, because as long as the Ukrainians are fighting the Russians, we don't need it. But I'm one of the few who has this opinion. The most politicians here are just not brave enough, smart enough, educated enough for that. So it's not going to be an upbeat, optimistic call, people, today. I'm sorry. So we have to be realistic that the problem is that in the United States, you have a presidential candidate who hates Zelensky and is begging Putin to keep him out of prison by helping him win the election. And in Europe, you still have politicians like Scholz and others who are like, yeah, but you know, maybe Putin will get reasonable and we can go back to normal business, or we don't need to invest that much in defense. We can still have the peace dividend. And I'm telling you, we're not going to have a peace dividend in Europe for 20 years. And if the Russians win, we're not going to have a peace dividend in Europe for the next 50 years. So,
because there won't be any peace.
Yes, there will be a continuous threat from Russia, and we will maybe even fight continuous wars as long as Putin and anyone from his inner circle is in power in Russia. And our best hope is to defeat the Russians now by killing as many of them as possible in Ukraine. And to do that, we have to give the Ukrainians whatever they want, whatever they need, even if it means that if the Europeans would have decided 2 years ago to start military production, we could give Ukraine now what they want, but we didn't. But even if we give Ukraine now whatever we want, right? Whatever they want, yes, for the next 2 years, we wouldn't have this equipment in Europe. But for the next 2 years, the Russians would be really, really busy trying to fight the Ukrainians, and we can rebuild what we gave the Ukrainians. But it would require a politician who is like, well, I take the responsibility. I explained to my people that peace is over, war has begun. It's not just what I like say here. The war has really begun because the Russians obviously think that they are at war with the West. And Ukraine is for them like the first country they need to defeat and conquer. And yeah, but in Europe, not a single politician, except for some Scandinavian, like in Finland and Norway and Sweden, went out there, or in the Baltics, to tell their people. But the money is in Western Europe. And I mean, if the United States...
And the stocks, the existing stocks, yes, are in Western Europe.
Yeah, and not even that. I mean, if the United States says, you know, we stop giving Ukraine weapons, then the Europeans could just tell the Americans, well, okay, can we buy equipment for the Ukrainians? And, well, why wouldn't the Americans sell it? Then basically, yes, it's going to be expensive for Europe, but the Ukrainians would get still what they need. But you would need a European politician that has the balls to tell his people and the Europeans that it's needed for our safety that we do it.
A friend of the space, who is a reasonable number in Parliament in Norway, and one of the leaders of the Foreign Affairs Committee and the Defense Committee there, they have already considered since end of last year, and I think we once talked about it, have considered since end of last year simply acquiring ammunition from the US. And both in use of the EDA, where they said, okay, we'll take all the other costs if there's anything, and if that's allowed, up to the level, and alternative buying under the FMC. And they have not yet been able to contract. That's the idea. Malcolm, it seems that both also in the NSC and in the Pentagon, there is a, they haven't made up their mind whether they want Ukraine really to win, right?
Russia,
or have they?
I hear this analysis from time to time by people who are extremely pessimistic that, the NSC has decided they don't want, the high level, you're talking Jake Sullivan, the president, the vice president, don't want Ukraine to win, and that the Secretary of Defense does. I can only give you what I know. And, I will continue to name drop.
That's why I'm asking you.
I'll continue to name drop here because, guys, I usually don't tell anybody anything in these forums till it's about 6 months out of date. So last June, when I met with Minister Reznikov, when he gave us a private briefing, one of the things he made absolutely clear that was the greatest friend Ukraine has is Secretary of Defense Austin. And he said Austin leans so far over that he gets the Pentagon to package ready everything that is ever asked or decided at the working groups in Ramstein. And then what he does is he leans really far out over, like getting them on the pier next to the national, next to the ship or the aircraft that is going to transport them. And all he is waiting for is a signature. And the moment that it's signed or that it's agreed upon by the White House and that the signature is done by the president, and the good example of that is the Bradleys and the Abrams. They were pre-positioned next to the roll-on, roll-off ships, and they were literally boarding within the hour of them being legally authorized for transfer. But as you know, we have a Congress that controls the purse strings. And that's why when we do these defense allocations of equipment, if it's not considered DRMO, right? Defense reutilizing materials. If it's equipment that's being transferred, you actually have to pay that, right? You have to pay the shipping costs, you have to pay all these things, and that's where the allocations are coming from. And they can't come from current active U.S. defense funding. There's funding for this. But Austin, leans way over. And Reznikov, before he transferred over and passed the job on to Ruslan, he said, this guy wants us to win. And when I mean win, to get everything that we have. Now, where's the bottleneck? The bottleneck comes in at the National Security Council. Everyone knows Jake. It's been well said, Jake Sullivan is an incrementalist, but Jake Sullivan is also was a baby diplomat who has only been a bureaucrat. He has never served in the armed forces. He has never served overseas, apart from going out on congressional delegations or fact-finding delegations. He is not a practitioner, so he doesn't have a practitioner's mindset. General Austin was commander of Europe, right? And Central Command. This is a man that kills people. So it shows the two different operating philosophies, but we are under civilian authority. And so long as Congress does not authorize us to transfer these weapons, it doesn't matter what systems we want to give to Ukraine, whether it's NSM, missiles or increased allocations of Patriot or buying Patriots from our allies, which is what's going on. We're buying every spare pack, two, three missile in the world, from NATO allies and replacing them with new stocks that give them theater capability, theater ballistic missile capability. But those are being consumed. This war consumes everything almost immediately. So that's why things appear dire. Not that Ukraine's going to run out of missiles. Ukraine can run out of missiles at the wrong time because the Russians are relying on the Republicans. They're relying on Moscow Mike Johnson, the Speaker of the House, and definitely relying on Donald Trump to tell them what to do. And the word on the street right now is Ukraine gets nothing. And like I said, everything is coming down to 16 Republicans who could lose their job this November because they're in Biden districts, where Joe Biden won those districts, and they won as sort of flukes. They will all lose their job, and they're trying to make a strategic decision. Do I lose Republican support from Trump and the MAGA and get, you know, have people literally threaten their lives? Or do I win this district again come November by assisting Joe Biden? So that's where it's all come down to.
Thomas.
He is very right. The thing is, Donald Trump wants to stay out of prison. To do that, he needs to win the election and be president and pardon himself. And throw the judges all in jail and the prosecutors have them whacked by the FBI and so on. He knows he's not going to win the election unless Putin helps him with smearing his adversary, Joe Biden, as he did with the fake Hunter Biden story already, the Russians, that was a whole Russian hoax. And so basically Trump is blocking Ukraine aid in a bid to beg Putin for the help to keep him out of prison, which means that Trump is absolutely compromised. I mean, he couldn't get a single job at any American government intelligence agency because a guy is so much in debt and so much in legal trouble is a mark for Russian intelligence to blackmail. And you don't need to blackmail Trump because he's basically throwing himself at the Russian intelligence and begging them to do their bidding. And right now he thinks the Russians don't even have to tell him. He understands that the Russians want him right now to block and help destroy Ukraine. And he's doing it. And he's doing it also because he tried to blackmail Zelensky into helping him in 2016 with the election by having Zelensky start a fake investigation of Joe Biden. And Zelensky said no, and that led to the first impeachment of Trump. So obviously Trump hates Zelensky for that. And you have an American presidential candidate whose whole political platform is right now to please the main enemy of the United States so he can keep out of prison. And the great shame of the United States is that the Republican Party goes along with it. They're absolute traitors because, I mean, every single person who has just a little bit of intelligence can see that Donald Trump is not running for American president. He's running for Putin's favorite bitch. And the Republicans are like, cool, that's the American way, you know, submit ourselves to the whims of a dictator in a foreign country who wants to harm the United States. The Republican Party is an enemy of the United States. It's the Al-Qaeda of our times because they hate America. Because if they would love the United States, they would see that their candidate, the leading man in their party, whose whole interest aligns not with the United States, his whole interest aligns with the country whose dream is to destroy the United States, to turn it into a hellhole, to make it poor, to break it, to have Americans fight each other, best in a civil war. This is absolutely traitorous. And the Republican Party is like, we love it. We are gonna stick with Putin against the United States. If you still think this party is
working. I agree with you on a large extent that the party has corrupted itself. But at the same time, there are elements in the party who are resisting that. So Mr. Trump actually does not even have his whole party under control. And that's the interesting thing. He may not have any majority hopes anyway. He cannot win the election at this point in time, no matter what kind of polls he scores. He won't win, won't win independents. He won't win all Republicans.
I think you overestimate the hold that Trump has on the Republicans. I mean, I used to be a Republican way back when. You know, now on the XY matrix, I'm way far to the lower left corner, crazy liberal, because I had the same philosophy as Colin Powell, right? National security heavy, socially liberal on some things. Now the Overton window has moved so far to the right and up that you cannot consider yourself a Republican if you're MAGA. One of my good friends is Michael Steele, former chairman of the Republican National Committee. 2 years ago, they told him, do not come to any Republican events. You are not welcome. You are not MAGA. The number that I think you think that are still Republican holdouts for Ukraine, you may be right. On every other issue, it's 100% Trump. Okay, let me rephrase that. 99% Trump. And you're right, he won't win the election, but he holds one third of the American electorate in lockstep.
Which brings me back to the 800,000 shells of ammunition and whether it is sufficient for Ukraine to have support from Western Europe. This is why I asked Thomas about the fact that we both know, and I think you do know as well, Malcolm, that there is more than enough in inventory in Western Europe. Yes, the generals don't want to give it away. It takes politicians with courage to say, we're going to give this, like, by the way, our friend in Denmark, Frederiksen, she simply decided, we give all our artillery and all our artillery ammunition to Ukraine because that's where it's needed. Other politicians could follow, should follow, they don't. Is the tiding over enough? Because the election will probably not swing in the favor of someone like him. If he actually ever stands for the election, we'll see. But please, Thomas.
The Ukraine has hit an immense amount of ammunition. Because even if they get a million shells from Europe, the Europeans only produce high explosive shells. There are so few countries that produce cluster munitions nowadays. Turkey, Israel, South Korea. You need those because the Russian infantry attacks, you kill those best if you have cluster munitions. I mean, you see the Russians advance and then the clusters come down and half the Russians are then on the floor, gravely injured or dead. And if we want Ukraine to attack, we need to give them 3 million artillery shells. We need to give them long-range weapons. Taurus, not just that. I mean, the F-16 have to come with cruise missiles so that they can strike deep in the Russian rear. The Ukrainians need many, many more tanks. But, you know, the Australians are replacing 59 M1A1 Abrams tanks. And they're not willing to give those to the Ukrainians, even though they're getting the M1A2 now. So there's a whole bunch of countries out there who could do so much more, who could make a decisive decision to help Ukraine with equipment. Australia doesn't really need tanks right now. And next year, they start to begin receiving the new tanks that they bought from the United States, right? The M1A2. The Ukrainians need tanks right now. So Australia say, okay, we give the Ukrainians the tanks we have. Because nobody's going to attack Australia in the next year because the Chinese nobody has the capability except for the United States to land forces on Australia's shores, right? And nope, not going to do it. And that's the problem, that we have so many politicians who are not giving Ukraine everything that we have in stock. And even if we gave everything in stock, it wouldn't be enough because we would still have to produce more because, as Malcolm said, this war consumes everything right away. So if we give Ukraine a million artillery shells, the Ukrainians would use them to attack the Russians, try to advance, try to crush Russian positions, and so on. So the shells will be gone, and then they need more. Does Europe produce enough to give to the Ukrainians? No. Have we raised production? Yes, we have raised production, but is the raised production enough? No. So we come back to the point that all these countries in Europe, I mean, people, NATO said you should spend 2% on defense in peacetime to retain capabilities. With 2%, you retain all the capabilities your military has. It's not 2% if you are at war, because it's way not enough for that. It's not 2% if you are in a Cold War, because it's way not enough for that. And the Europeans are now like, yeah, we should spend 2%. People, you should have spent 2% during the peace dividend to not atrophy your forces. Right now, with the Russians hell-bent on waging war after war, and believe me, once Putin is done with Ukraine, even if there's just a ceasefire at some point, Putin is not going to be satisfied with that. He might go after Ukraine just a year down the road, or he's going after the Baltics 1 or 2 years down the road. So here, people in Europe, 2% are the minimum to retain capabilities during peacetime. Right now, Europeans should spend 3.5% on defense, like Poland does, like the United States does, like the Baltics are about to do. So Ukraine needs shells. We can't deliver it because we didn't increase production fast enough. Now we're increasing production, but we're still increasing production, not for the times we live in, but for a kind of peace dividend level. Because honestly, if you would be serious about the threat we face, you would do what the United States did in World War II. You would just stamp out new factories from the ground in months. And you wouldn't just say people, oh, what do you want to work in this industry? You would just draft people to work in that industry. Like, we go back to have the draft. And if you don't want to be in the military, welcome. You spent a year in this ammunition factory now. Europeans are doing nothing of the sort. The only tank factories in all of Europe that run at full capacities are in Sweden and in Poland. The tank factories in Spain, in the UK, in Netherlands, in Germany, in Austria, in Switzerland, in Italy, in Greece, in Czechia, in Romania, and in Finland aren't running at full capacities because the politicians haven't yet had the courage to tell their people that we're going to need to spend more. Currently, the whole continent of Europe, I mean, it's a half a billion continent. If you combine the economic power, it's the wealthiest bloc in the world, in the history, even wealthier than the United States, all the European countries combined. How many tanks do we produce per month? One. The entire continent produces one main battle tank per month, 2 years into a war that is threatening the whole continent. This is clownish. This is a surrender defeatism. We need
and,
to produce.
And who do you, and Thomas, who do we deliver our most modern IFVs to?
To Hungary.
Wasn't that beautiful?
Yeah. And the thing is, we produce way too few. I mean, there's the Italian workers in the tank factories are on strike to demand that they finally stop being put into half-time work only because there's no orders. And I mean, the European Union should, because all the countries in Europe, in the Eurozone, right, are handicapped by this European Eurozone 3% deficit spending limit. The European Union, like with COVID, should decide to take up a credit and finance military production as a European Union as a whole. Because then you have from today, you have nothing, and tomorrow you have 750 billion or more money ready to invest in defense. And the European politicians wouldn't even have to tell their people anything that, you know, you have to spend more because it's European Union credit. So yes, you will have to pay it down as European Union in the future. But this needs to be done. We need to spend more. And the thing is, people are like, yes, but if we buy now tanks, are we sure we need it? No, but if we pay now for tanks the moment we need it, there are some. And if in the moment, in the meantime, we produce too many, the Ukrainians need it. And so I am a little bit exasperated with Europe because we are 2 years into a horrific war that is threatening this continent, and we haven't managed to increase production of missiles, production of fighter jets, production of frigates, production of submarines, production of infantry fighting vehicles. The only artillery production has increased is the Caesar in France and the Susanna II in Slovakia. everybody else is still twiddling their thumbs. The Germans have started a slow production run of the RCH-155, but, you know, it's like artisanal. Just to give you an idea, during the Cold War, there was 4 Leopard 2 tanks coming off the production lines every week. And right now, there's coming off 1 per month. So we went from 16 to 1. But don't forget, the Leopard 2 tank in the Cold War was just produced in Germany. The Italians, the French, the British were producing their own tanks. So we had lots more tank factories. And in total, there were like 50 tanks coming off the production lines per month in Europe in the 80s. Right now, we're
coming... And the chassis for the RCH should not be produced in the format as it's being produced now. This should be produced under contract by MAN or someone.
The thing is that the whole thing is a joke because, I mean, since this is the most modern artillery system, right? And you can mount it on anything. You can mount it on trucks. You can mount it on wheeled infantry fighting vehicles. Wheeled armored vehicles, you can mount it on tracked armored vehicles, you can mount it on anything. There should be a European program to just say, okay, we produce 50 of those a month and every country that's needed, so every country that has something where it can be mounted on, gets it under the condition you get this most modern of European artillery systems for a lower price because the European Union is subsidizing it. If whatever you replace with this modern system, you give to Ukraine. And suddenly you would see that the Spanish are really gung-ho to give all the remaining M109 to the Ukrainians. And you would see even the Italians being gung-ho to give all the remaining Panzerhaubitze 2000 to Ukraine. But, you know, Europe is like, yeah, you know, we should do an artisanal run of like 1.5 per year maximum, 1.5 per month maximum. And it's like, at 1.5 per month, it would take a century to replace the old legacy artillery in Europe. I mean, Putin is going to wait a century for us to be ready. So, yeah, the thing is that Europe has not yet understood the dangers we are in. This is a Spanish Civil War moment, right? The Spanish Civil War signaled to the British we should maybe start to rearm because the Italians and the Germans are kind of on a path to another world war. And so the British began to rearm slowly, but they began to rearm. And then 3 years later, the Brits had enough equipment to at least defend their island from a German landing. And right now the Europeans are like, well, we are 2 years after the war started, and you know what? We have to do nothing. Neither increase production nor increase troop strength. I mean, the increase in military troop strength in Europe, except outside of Sweden and Poland, is also like absolutely unsatisfying.
This is back to one of the things which we've discussed before, and that is the lack of... commitment in the West. The political will is not there to engage seriously with what is a peer-to-peer conflict. Otherwise, the logistics would be sorted out after having agreed on a strategy, which evidently would have to be communicated with the public after political will has been formed. This is what General Ben Hodges has been advocating for and highlighted here quite specifically, McRyan derived very clearly and methodically, and Rear Admiral Parry said it in the very same vein today. There is a lack of leadership amongst the Western politicians, and there is a massive amount of complacency to overcome. We haven't shaken them up yet, quite, Thomas. What to do?
Shoot them.
No! No paintballing here.
The thing is that I'm extremely fed up because these politicians ditter and make, I mean, I saw today huge promises by these politicians on the internet, on Twitter, how they will stand with Ukraine, how they will not let the Ukrainians alone. And then I know that I'm observing all the time the European changes in military posture and military, you know, organizations and so on. And telling them we are getting ready for this new times. Sorry. And then I see that the Germans have been like, you know what? We are going to add 2 artillery battalions. That will do it. And the Italians are like, we are adding a cybersecurity regiment and a targeting, artillery targeting regiment. That will do it. The French, well, we're going to add nothing. And the Spanish, oh, we're going to add nothing. And the Polish are adding 2 divisions. Good. The Finnish, the Swedish army is adding 2 brigades and creating a armored division, which will be able to defend Sweden. Okay, good. Someone has understood it. The British army is like, you know what? We should cut our force now, because in this time, the best answer is to have less military. It's a little bit, how to say, it's a little bit discouraging that in a phase like that, where we have been given a window to strengthen ourselves, not to fight Russia, but to deter Russia by our determination and the capabilities of our militaries, we have chosen to do nothing and signal this way to Russia, feel free to attack us, which will happen, because we are just a joke to the Russians until we start to be serious about our own defense, which we are absolutely not.
Excuse me?
Yes?
I'm come from Denmark, and...
sorry, Ulrich, this is not how it works. Not how it works. You can't just interrupt here. Sorry.
No, if he has something to say about Denmark...
Yeah, but it's not his turn at the moment. We will come to him at the moment. I have CC, I have Wardogger and David in the order, and Ulrich, please, don't do this again. That's not polite. So, if you want to go...
He actually made very positive comments about Denmark, how Denmark was the only nation that was understanding they had to fight the war in Ukraine and not in Denmark.
Yep, absolutely, absolutely right. And Mette Frederiksen has been at the forefront of a change in policy, which is astonishing for Denmark. We discussed it earlier this morning with Jakob Kaspel, you will remember, and the former Danish military intelligence officer. But Thomas, you were saying?
No, I'm done. The thing is that we here in the space, the people that listen, the people that love Ukraine, we understand what is happening. And it's exasperating for us to see that the politicians in Europe do not understand what is happening. And this endangers all of the continent, because we are sleepwalking into a disaster that will be way more horrific if we are not readying ourselves to deter the Russians now. And there's just no will in Europe to be ready. And one thing I have to say to Malcolm about Jake Sullivan is a typical Scholz guy. He's like, you know, increment really little, do as little as possible, all the time hope that Putin will come to his senses. And, you know, Putin is not coming to his senses. I mean, if you watch the Tucker Carlson interview, the only takeaway you can have, this guy is a loon. This guy is in the stages of Hitler 1943, he's completely lost any kind of relation with reality, and sees enemies everywhere he has to fight to the death. And there is absolutely no way you can negotiate with Putin. And Sullivan and Scholz are like, yeah, but you know, if just a little bit more, and then Putin will come to his senses. And it's a complete ridiculous belief. But we have this kind of people rule Europe that are delusional.
But in Germany, it's the whole government, unfortunately. We've seen this just now. It's astonishing.
The Greens in Germany know what's up, but they're too scared and they cling too much to their seats to do something about it.
You just put it right, thank you. Because if you look at the Wall Street Journal hosted the panel which was published yesterday with David Cameron, who's returned to politics, as we all know, as a foreign minister of the king, or the king's government in this case, and Annalena Baerbock, as well as Radek Sikorski. and they were there. And if you listen to Ms. Baerbock, there was not a single mentioning of Ukraine's victory. This was all about deterrence. This was all about containment. This was about support. As our friend Beefeater quite rightly said, and I think you were the one who first coined it, if I'm quite mistaken, support and whatever it takes is the language of defeat. Because it's not whatever it takes on how long it takes. No. It's destined supply what is needed to achieve victory at the earliest possible time. Malcolm has seen the images. He knows the intelligence. Malcolm, you can confirm this. The atrocities the Russians commit to, both to the civilians in occupied territories as well as any soldier, are beyond what people believe. You cannot allow the territory to remain under Russian control.
You know, I'm gonna tell you real quick, because it's not often that you actually can see Bucha level things. But when we did the counteroffensive in Kharkiv, I'm sorry, not Kharkiv, Kupiansk, and my battalion, our platoon, was the spearhead to go across the Oskil River and seize the eastern side of the city of Kupiansk from the Russian VDV. The first thing we stumbled on is what we called the gas station of the damned. And it was a gas station. If you go over the bridge, it was on fire. And as we were moving through, you suddenly realize there were dead bodies all around us. And what had happened was people had found that Kupiansk was liberated and were trying to go across the bridge to the Oskil River. And the Russians just gunned everybody down. There were 8 bodies right there in the road, a truck that had been blasted that was carrying flour for the sole crime of going, you know, towards that bridge to get link up with civilians, to link up with Ukrainian forces. And their sentence was death. And that happened, that was everywhere, you know, but that one was a pretty blatant one.
If I keep telling people to watch World War II movies about resistance fighters in France, a resistance fighter in Norway or other occupied areas of Europe, because what the Gestapo did, those methods, torture, kidnapping, extrajudicial killings, murdering people, that's exactly what the Russians are doing in the occupied territories. They're doing it as we speak. Right now, the Russians are going around probably somewhere and trying to find some Ukrainians who don't support Russia. They're going to take them and torture them. And if they don't admit to what they do or don't give names of other people, the Russians will murder them and ditch their bodies in rivers or in ravines. So the Russians, if you want to know what is happening right now in the occupied areas where the Russian Gestapo, which is the FSB, it's a different version of Gestapo, because, I mean, they murder, you see with Navalny, they just murder people left and right. If you want to know what is happening in these occupied areas, go watch some World War II movies about the French resistance. And then you will know exactly what the Russians are right now doing. Our politicians all know it. Baerbock and Scholz and Sullivan. But, you know, it's like they don't want to tell the people, because, you know, they don't want to rock the boat. They don't want to have pressure to deliver more to Ukraine, because maybe Putin will be reasonable if we don't give him towers and back him for 2 more weeks not to do that and that. The Russians just got hundreds of rockets, ballistic missiles, from Iran. What are they going to do with that? They are going to try to overwhelm the Patriot system in Kiev. Sooner or later, they will fire 200 of those at Kiev in an afternoon in the hope the Patriot battery runs out of interceptors and the Russians have a free field of fire to smack down Kiev, kill 10,000. And what are we going to do? The Ukrainians need more Patriots. The Ukraine needs more interceptors. And the West is like, that would be escalatory. We can't do it.
Well, Thomas, Ms. Baerbock in the on the panel, which took about 46, 8 minutes, whatever, with the two others, when asked about her approach, She got a nice intro from David Cameron, who then highlighted how intensely she had confronted Lavrov at the G20, because they were sitting for dinner at the G20, and she then told Lavrov, in, as she meant, no uncertain terms, that we do not agree with you, you know, and try to shame him. And Cameron supported her that, yeah, he really only mumbled very ashamedly. And she said that contrary to 2 years ago, now nobody at the G20 was talking any Russian narratives or any excuses anymore. We were all in unison. That is an achievement. 2 years into the war and you think this is an achievement? That is a level of insanity and complacency and what the Germans call Realitätsferne, far remote from reality. That's it's astonishing.
We have such little people, you know. This is a success for them. This, I mean, this is, as you say, it's clownish. It's just embarrassing. This isn't, this should have been happening a month into the war. And they're praising themselves for these little achievements, which is...
Yep, I agree. Listen, guys, I have to go. It's been an hour and a half. And I want to thank you for having me on here. I'm getting ready. If any of you are in upstate New York, we're having a viewing of 20 Days of Mariupol in Hudson, New York, at a place called Time and Space Limited in about an hour and a half. And we have the chief of surgery from Mariupol Hospital and one of the Avastol defenders who was a prisoner of war. So I'm going to go start my day's remembrances. And I want to thank Mary Report for giving me this chance to talk today.
Thank you, Mark. Thank you. Very much appreciated.
Thank you very much. Sorry about the depressing tone of mine, but, you know, I'm a little bit exhausted by what I see in Europe because Europe is just not a serious continent.
You're right.
Thank you. Thank you.
Bye-bye, guys.
Good luck.
But this is not an excuse to give up. This is never an excuse to give up. By no means.
It isn't. The Ukrainians deserve our help, and we need to help them. The problem is that we need a better crop of politicians, and what we are being offered is a bunch of... I mean, these are little people, not serious. They don't understand. They don't want to understand the gravity of the situation. They don't want...
That's the thing. They are very unhappy that they've been disturbed in their little world. They had completely different plans for their administration, right?
Yep. The thing is, I mean, look around. The Israel-Hamas war is going to spiral out of control because Hamas cannot back down. Iran at some point cannot allow its proxy Hamas to be completely defeated. Israel has to go at some point into Lebanon because right now the Hezbollah there is firing at Israel. And basically the whole northern 20 kilometers of Israel are in constant alarm over Hezbollah missiles and rockets raining down, which is a completely impossible situation because you have basically a huge chunk of your country that is in uninhabitable because there's some guys firing rockets and missiles and drones and stuff over the border. Going into Lebanon, you see the war spiral out even further out of control. The Syrian regime will also then not be stand aside because Hezbollah is the people that basically kept Assad in power. So, and the Europeans are not ready for even that. But the Middle East is going to be even worse than it was the last 10 years. In the last 10 years, we had the Syrian civil war. And in Europe, nobody's even thinking about, you know, the consequences. I mean, there's going to be another 2 million refugees if that really hits off, if that really starts the war in Lebanon, because the Lebanese people are not going to stick around when Hezbollah and Hamas, the country is anyway already almost broke and destroyed, when they're going to then have a war. Is Europe prepared? No. Are the politicians even thinking about that? What will happen if they're not ready? No. They are going to conferences and then slapping each other on the shoulder for what great jobs they have been doing, when in fact they have been doing absolutely Nothing. Nothing that is remotely enough for the world we live in. And I will repeat myself, weakness invites aggression, and the European continent gives an image of, to Putin and other dictators, of an extremely weak, unwilling to defend itself continent, and that's just going to invite more and more aggression. The Eastern Europeans understand it, and they're getting ready and trying to defend themselves, but the only one that understands it in Germany is Pistorius, the defense minister, who is basically mushing a German brigade into Lithuania, which every other European big nation, Italy, France, Spain, the UK, should be doing too. Because people need to understand deterrence is always cheaper than war. Deterrence is the cheapest way to preserve peace. But for deterrence, you need to be serious in investing in your defense capabilities.
Admiral Parry this afternoon highlighted once more his key point and saying that we are beyond the point of deterrence. Europe has to actually invest heavily in defense and assume a defense posture, which goes significantly beyond that, because it has failed in deterrence.
It has failed in deterrence, and if we're not going to do it, it will invite the Russians to invade the Baltics or Poland or even worse, the Scandinavian countries. The thing is that even if investment in deterrence you can sell to your voters, right? Defense posture is more difficult, but in the end, it's the same. The Europeans have to invest in a defense posture, which would signal to the Russians, sure, you can attack Europe, the Baltics, Poland, Romania, whatever. But do you see how many troops we have there? Do you see how ready we are for that? This is the deterrence to make the Russians understand that, yes, they can invade, but the costs will be high because Europe has readied itself for such an event. Right now, Europe is not readying itself for such an event, giving an opening for the Russians, because, I mean, if you're a Russian general and you're like, except for Finland, you're looking at the other countries up there and you're like, well, the Europeans could definitely, definitely defeat Russia, but the European brigades are all that could fight the Russians and defeat the Russians are all in Western Europe. Not a single one of them, except for this German brigade, is moving east. That will be easy. Because just imagine, Russia invades the Baltics. The Europeans and NATO decide we need to stick with Article 5 and defend the Baltics, right? Okay, now you have, let's say Trump has won the elections. There goes the United States. They're not going to come with us. Okay, so the Europeans have to do it alone. Next problem, the European brigades who could eject the Russians from the Baltics or from Gotland in Sweden are based in Spain, west of Madrid, in Italy, around Naples, in South Germany and in the UK, in the south of London, in Salisbury Plain and so on. And yes, now you have to move these troops east. Congratulations. It will take 2-3 weeks and you have to move to Germany with your trains full of equipment. And can you imagine how many Russian paid loons will block the railroads, will tie themselves to the railways, will block the unloading of ships? Once the Russians have attacked Europe, their fifth column will prevent European military movements. It will take weeks, if not months, to move equipment through Germany because hundreds of kilometers of railroad, Russian fifth columnists, financed, organized, motivated by the Russian intelligence services, and you see it with the German nuclear transports. These people just come, lay down on the railroad tracks, use handcuffs, connect themselves to the railways, and the train stops. And it takes hours for the German police to take these people away without injuring them. And well, meanwhile, you have 300 kilometers.
Thomas, in a defense case, you in a defense case, you can say send the Feldjäger there, the military police, but it has to be the Defensivfall, and then you don't then you don't have to respect what they do there. You can literally do anything.
I would hope so. The thing is that you have in Germany two parties in parliament who will insist that Germany doesn't do it. They will go to the main national court. They will try to have it blocked and so on. You have Hungary. The Italians need to ship through Slovenia and Hungary or to Austria and Germany to reach the Eastern Europe. Hungary can block it. Then, okay, you have to go to Austria. Now in Austria, if next election the FPÖ wins, the Italians are not going to be able to ship their equipment through Austria. They will have to go into France, from France into Germany, from Germany into Poland. So the Europeans, the problem here is that we need to move east. During the Cold War, the Belgian army was mostly based in Germany. The Dutch army was partially based in Germany. The US army had four divisions in Germany. The British army had three of its four combat formation divisions in Germany, and so on and on. Why? Because they understood if there's a war, we need to be there where the war is fought. We don't have the luxury to spend days, weeks, months to ship equipment all over the continent to reach where the Soviets are attacking. The Europeans have ignored that lesson. The European militaries are capable of defeating the Russians. They don't have the ammunition right now. We could produce it. We could deter the Russians from ever trying to invade a European country. But for that, European military forces need to be where the Russians would invade. Right now, if you are Spanish, the Spanish have four heavy brigades in Spain, which means that when the Russians invade, these four brigades are useless unless you can ship them to the war area, all to Spain, lots of pro-Russians that might block roads and railroads. Even there's Russian agents that might even blow up bridges. In the Cold War, there was a whole Russian sleeper cell organization whose sole task was to destroy bridges and tunnels in Western Europe to slow down equipment that would come to Germany or Italy to the front. The Russians might even have restarted that program. So you would have maybe in the Pyrenees or in France, bridges that have been blown up by Russian spies. So the Europeans don't understand. If you want to deter the Russians, we have to move. Each European country, the big ones, Spain, France, UK, Germany, Italy, have to move a brigade right now into the Baltics. The Germans are doing it because their defense minister understands it. Nobody else is doing it because everybody else just doesn't want to understand or thinks that it's not necessary because the Russians will come through their senses any moment now. And I can tell you, no, they will not come through their senses.
And it's so, yeah. And Thomas, it's fair to say that both von Sandrart as well as Freuding made very clear that it's absolutely necessary to honor the commitment which was once made politically.
Because if the Western nations do not honor their NATO commitment, NATO is broken. Then I guarantee you every country who doesn't want to be subjugated by Russia will go for nuclear weapons. Sweden, Finland, the Poles, Italy. If Trump wins the election, the Italians, the Dutch, the Belgians, the Turkish have nuclear weapons, due to the NATO nuclear weapons sharing agreement between these countries and the United States. So in case of an attack on NATO, Italy, Belgium, Netherlands, they could get nuclear weapons from the United States to be used with Dutch, German. Also, Germany has this agreement and fighter jets as a deterrent for the Russians to attack, you know, these countries, because, you know, the Germans could then nuclearly fire back with bombs. If Trump wins the election, that's gone. And then what to do if you're a European country? Either you get your own nuclear weapons or you pay the French to protect you, but will the French honor that if the Russians come at us? So you will have nuclear weapons all over Europe. Nuclear weapons all over Europe means also that if the Russians attack, these countries will use them. So you don't want nuclear weapons in Europe, you don't want nuclear war in Europe, then tell your politicians to start moving troops east and start buying equipment in serious numbers. European people don't understand it. Politicians don't want to speak about it. And yeah, so we're looking at a pretty bleak, problematic future if we're not, because the Ukrainians are dying to give us an opening, like the Spanish were dying to give the West an opening. In the longer the Spanish held out, in the Spanish Republic held out against the Francoist regime that was supported by Italian volunteers and German troops, the longer the Europeans had time to basically begin preparing their own militaries to fight. Some European countries used it. The UK used it much better than the French. Right now, the Ukrainians are doing this for us Europeans, and the Europeans are like, yeah, we don't need that. I'm pretty sure every general will tell, I mean, there is generals out there who warn that the Russians in 4 or 5 years would be ready to attack Europe, and that we are not ready and we need to start. We are already late, but we have to get ready for that possibility, and we're just not. So this anniversary, the Ukrainians are still fighting. We have to support them, as we have been doing the last 2 years. We have to support them even more as Europeans, because they are dying to give us the chance to defend ourselves. But we need to take the opportunity, or this gift that the Ukrainians are giving us with their blood. We need to accept it and say, yes, thank you, and now we're going to invest in our own defense, because you have given us the chance even to do it. And the Europeans are just like, yeah, not doing it. This is a pessimistic view of the world, yes. But, you know, I told people in October 2021, the Russians will invade Ukraine. There's absolutely no doubt in my mind that the Russians are ready for war. And people didn't believe me until basically the 20th of February. With everything that I told since then, that the Russians will not step back, they will not reconsider. The only thing that really surprised me about the Russians is that the Russian people can accept 300,000-400,000 dead Russian soldiers and still don't care about these losses of Russian life. That's the only surprising thing. But the Russian regime, the first thought when I heard Navalny is dead was Putin is never going to give the body back to the family, because giving the body back allows for tests how he was killed, how he was murdered. So he doesn't want that. And secondly, giving the body back means that there could be a funeral, which could turn into a demonstration against Putin, and Putin doesn't want that. And people are like, oh, Putin is going to give the body back. And now you see that threatening his mom to never give the body back unless she basically accepts the conditions that the regime is putting to her of not having a public funeral for her son. So the Russian regime, if you just have a little bit of understanding of the Russian culture, it's easy to understand. And if you listen to Putin, he's not speaking about Ukraine. He's speaking always about the Russian Empire, the former Russian Empire, the Soviet Empire, and so on. And that Russian Empire includes Bulgaria, Moldavia, Romania, Azerbaijan, Georgia, Poland, East Germany, Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania, even Finland. So when people are like saying that the Russians are not hell-bent on war, I just have to tell these people, no, the Russians are hell-bent on war. People are deluding themselves if they think they're not.
All right, Thomas, thank you very much. We've gone a little bit over, but then again, we had this lag from the initial technical delays with Malcolm and Rajan, so we now have to cut a few corners. But I can see that one of our guests who was also scheduled for this time is Princess. She's come up. I tried to get Christoph to join because they are seeing me both together, if I'm not quite mistaken. Christopher, can you hear us?
Okay, let me conclude quickly.
Yeah, of course.
Just quickly conclusion. Sure. There's three things that the continent of Europe has to do. A, we have to organize a European-wide acquisition program for our own militaries, financed by the European Union, so these politicians stop putting their head in the sand because the European Union can just, you know, overrule the nation's capitals. Second, we have to use this to help Ukraine with ammunition because this country is bleeding dry. Third, the Ukrainians have to mobilize more men because the soldiers that have been fighting 2 years deserve a break. And you have to mobilize another 500,000 men in Ukraine. Then the future is better, not bright, but it's better and we have a chance. If we do nothing of that, good night. Let's move to New Zealand because it will be the only place without Russian occupation at some point.
Absolutely, 100%. Thomas, thank you very much for taking the time today and much appreciated that you spent a few more minutes to clarify this. I think that Chuck and I are very, very content with what you've highlighted.